Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Gas and Flame Men, Baseball and the Chemical Warfare Service During World War I, by Jim Leek, narrated by Barry Abrams. I think war is all that Sherman said it was, and a little bit worse. Captain Christopher Mathewson. God, how I hate the 20th century! George C. Scott. Patton. 1. Nashville. Charles Gabby Street stepped out of a cold spring downpour into a downtown Nashville hotel. Ballplayers from the American League Washington Senators sat around inside playing pinochle and reading newspapers, their late March exhibition game with the Nashville Volunteers washed out. The news was as gloomy as the weather, front pages rumbling about the European war and America's long slide toward involvement. President Woodrow Wilson took steps today to place the nation on a war footing, one article began. A few players cast their papers aside and headed out for nearby motion picture theaters. One or two perhaps recognized the big fellow stepping into the lobby. Gabby looked exactly like what he was, an aging catcher and former senator who played now for the local team that fans called the Vols. He took life at the gallop, on the field and off. Gabby was no angel in younger days, nor was he frugal. Admits he liked to play around with one foot on brass rail, Sporting News later recalled. Bad habits had hampered his career early on, and he lacked only the development of a little common sense to land among the majors, a Washington newspaper once said. This streak of light dawned on him when he married in 1907 and decided to settle down. 34 years old now, with a wife but no children, Gabby had been up to the major leagues and back down again. 14 professional seasons behind the plate had left him with bouts of rheumatism and a collection of knitty fingers, all but one of which he had broken some 2 or 3 times. He'd once caught 8 doubleheaders in 9 days, an experience that would have put 9 catchers out of 10 in the hospital for keeps. An inch under 6 feet tall and weighing 185 pounds, Gabby was tough and determined and not about to give up the national pastime. He gazed about the lobby, looking for the Kansas farm boy he'd helped shape into a pitching star in the nation's capital. Walter Johnson was 5 years younger than the catcher. Fans called him Barney, after race car driver Barney Oldfield, and also the Big Train. Both nicknames derived from the tremendous speed of his fastball. Johnson credited Gabby with helping him learn how to pitch in the big leagues after his call-up to Washington nearly a decade ago. When Gabby Street was in his prime, the hurler had written, he was the best catcher I ever saw, I think. Perhaps old-timers can recall backstops who surpassed him, but to me he was the ideal man behind the bat. Gabby kept pitchers at ease by chattering like a magpie behind the plate. Ease up on this fellow, Walter. He has a wife and 2 children, he would call jokingly when some batter was hugging the plate and getting a toehold for a crack at one of my fast ones, Johnson wrote. This fellow hasn't made a hit off you since you joined the league, would probably be his next remark, and so on throughout the game. Johnson clasped his one-time mentor's hand here in Nashville, a clutch of sports writers looking on with pencils poised. The meeting of the Smoke King and famous Gabby yesterday was the first reunion these athletes have had since Gabby dropped out of the big show 5 years ago, the Washington Herald said. To no one's surprise, it was the backstop who spoke first. Barney, you're looking great, Gabby said, his Alabama upbringing evident in his drawl. So are you, Johnson replied, lying only a little. It was a touching sight, Lewis A. Doer wrote for the Washington Times, to see these old pals of many wonderful mound battles in the American League shake hands in the lobby of the Hermitage Hotel. The friends settled in and began catching up. Johnson was starting his 11th season in Washington, while Gabby had long since fallen into the Southern Association, a Class A circuit 2 rungs below the American League. The star of the King of Pitchers still is all a glitter, the Washington Star's Denman Thompson wrote. That of Street lacks the luster of the majors, though in Dixie, Gabby still is rated with the wisest. The gap in their status didn't affect the reunion. Walter Johnson, the noblest pitching Roman of them all, sat in the Hermitage lobby practically all afternoon chinning with Gabby Street, sports writer Bob Pike wrote in the Nashville Banner, or rather getting chinned by Gabby, as it takes a peach of a bird to get in a word edgewise when this Mr. Charles Gabby Street is anywhere close. I guess I'm getting old, the catcher said, as time flowed past like rainwater outside. But I'm good for a couple of more years down here when the sun shines in the summer. My wing is still delivering the goods. My legs are quitting me, though, and I do lose some good hits because I can't get down to first. But they'll have to come out with a sheriff and his deputies to take me off the diamond. I'm going to stick till they come for me with the hearse. The hurler said he was slowing, too, but his former battery mate wasn't having it. Johnson could lose 2/3 of his good stuff, Gabby said, and still be a wonder. He not only is a wonderful pitcher, but a fine gentleman, the catcher added after their chinning session. It was good to see him again. Mighty good. Vols manager Roy Ellum sent automobiles for the Senators the following day as the cold and damp weather continued. The players toured Nashville and the surrounding countryside and even visited the state prison 16 miles away. Back in town, cameramen got Gabby and Johnson to shake hands again for the newsreels. Years from now, when their playing days were done, the big train would include Gabby Street on his personal list of all-time major leaguers, ranking him with Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Joe Jackson, and other horsehide luminaries. Since Gabby left the major leagues, there has never been a catcher in his class, he told scribes in Tennessee. Then the pitcher added, he had the best throwing arm in the big show, and whenever a runner would start to steal, Gabby's peg was on a line and would cut him down. I've seen many catchers in the big leagues since Gabby left, but I've yet to discover one who can show the stuff that Gabby did in his prime. I'm mighty glad to see Gabby doing so well in Nashville, for he's a great fellow all the way and deserves all the success in the world. The weather never cooperated for the two old pals, and the Senators left town without playing their exhibition with the Volunteers. But other events were vastly more important. Nearly 2 years earlier, a German U-boat had sunk the passenger liner Lusitania and began a ruinous decline in relations between Berlin and Washington. On April 6, 1917, 10 days after the big train departed Nashville, the United States declared war on Germany. America entered the European conflict on the side of Great Britain, France, and Belgium. Ball players throughout the Southern Association and in other leagues around the country started their year amid uncertainty and worry. The fast-gathering war clouds threatened the most prosperous season and outlook in the history of Dixie's major league, the Nashville Tennessean said. But unless the pressure of the United States being involved in the world conflict produces unexpected happenings, the season will pass off as successfully as anticipated. Nashville's veteran catcher took the war bulletins stoically. Gabby Street galloped around the running track some 3 miles yesterday, sports writer Claude Blinky Horn wrote in the Tennessean, but will never again repeat the long-distance racing, since the scale showed he had sloughed off some 4 pounds somewhere on his lengthy journey. Horn added that Gabby is already down to fightin' trim and wailed long and loud over the loss of the poundage. Staying trim wasn't all that occupied the veteran backstop's mind as the Vols prepared for their season opener. Gabby likely was already thinking about a greater and grimmer contest, one he wouldn't fight with bat and ball in the safety of a grassy park. 2. Gabby. Charles Evard Street was born in Huntsville, Alabama on September 30, 1882, the second of 5 children in a farming family. He was a soldier before he was a ball player, following an uncle into the 1st Alabama Volunteer Infantry at age 15 during the Spanish-American War. A sports editor wrote later that the streets were just naturally a fighting clan. Charlie was an unruly soldier who spent much of his enlistment in the guardhouse. His regiment had reached Jacksonville, Florida, when combat ended in Cuba, which the teenager surely regretted. He began his baseball career not long afterward, playing semi-pro and independent ball after high school in Huntsville. The Tyro attended South Kentucky College in 1901-02 at Hopkinsville, where he majored in catching for the school's baseball team. He made his professional debut the next year with the Hopkinsville Browns in the Kentucky-Illinois-Tennessee League, a new Class D circuit fans called the Kitty League. Charlie accepted $60 a month to catch for the club, he recalled, because it was big money, equivalent to about $1,800 today. Hopkinsville traded him in 1904 to the Terre Haute Hottentots of the Class B Central League, which at the end of the season sold his contract to the Cincinnati Reds. The National League club had room for Charlie as a backup catcher because another late call-up, Branch Rickey of the Texas League, hadn't stayed after catching a pair of exhibition games. Joe Kelly managed the club, and he was no choir boy, the Brooklyn Eagle said long afterward. Learning that Rickey, keeping a promise to his mother, didn't play ball on Sundays, Kelly snapped, "You'll catch here tomorrow, kid, or you're through." Other reasons cited for Rickey's departure were that he simply hadn't impressed the club and that he was committed to teaching and coaching football at a college in Pennsylvania. Just how many more of the half-baked are to be given autumn tryouts is not now known, Sporting Life jibed. Rickey left town and Charlie Street landed the Reds' job. His new teammates called the catcher Alabama. Aside from a brief stint on loan to the Boston Bean Eaters, he managed to stick with the Reds through 1905 before slipping back to the minors the following year. He had played 11 games for the San Francisco Seals in the Pacific Coast League, PCL, when the great earthquake of April 1906 hurled him out of bed. The Seal was living at the Golden Gate Hotel, popular with ballplayers and actors. Charlie scrambled into the street with cast members from Beauty and the Beast and Babes in Toyland, getting drenched when a roof water tower collapsed. The group huddled that night in Golden Gate Park with the city ablaze around them. The catcher spent 2 days clearing city streets of bricks and rubble under soldiers' orders before hopping a ferry across the bay to Oakland. Charlie later said he had been planning to jump the Seals and join the Williamsport, Pennsylvania club in the independent Tri-State League. The fire that followed the trembler consumed his ticket along with the railway office. He made his way slowly eastward with help from friends and refugee organizations, and he played the rest of the season in the Keystone State with the Williamsport Millionaires. Charlie was playing with Frisco when the earthquake came, and he demanded and got his unconditional release, so he had the right to go to the Outlaws or anywhere else he pleased, fans in Huntsville read. He came east with only the clothes on his back, and he was gladly taken up by manager Jimmy Sebring for his Williamsport outfit. And now Charlie is not only hitting them out at the rate of 2 and 3 bingles daily, but he is the star backup and base runner of the whole Outlaw League. The Alabaman made Williamsport his winter home for many years. Charlie returned to the PCL in 1907 and married Williamsport native Mabel Grace Hurst in Bakersfield during spring training. The Seals were glad to have him back. It is not his faculty for receiving and steadying his pitcher that makes him valuable so much as his ability to make the base runners hug the cushions, a San Francisco newspaper said. His wonderful throwing arm is believed by many to be his chief stock in trade. The catcher enjoyed such a good season that the Senators beat out at least 2 other major league clubs to sign him the following winter. A story soon made the rounds, helped along by Charlie, that he had caught a record 179 games during the Seals' lengthy 203-game season. "I could have made it 185 just as easy as not," he told a Cincinnati sports writer, adding, "I never did quite so well in my life." A Bay Area paper scoffed, but cited a record that was impressive enough without embellishments. Official figures show that Street took part in 159 games last season on the coast, 154 being behind the bat and 5 at first base and in the field, the San Francisco Examiner said. Where he made a coast record of the catchers was the catching of 54 games straight when both his hands were injured. Street was one of the best catchers on the coast for many years, and Washington gets a man that will always be trying and who will deliver the goods. Washington's manager was Joseph Cantillon, known in baseball circles as Pongo Joe. He later took credit for anointing the Senators' new backstop, Gabby, although not for what sports writer Tom Rice called his conversational proclivities. Cantillon explained that he'd hung the moniker on him because Street called so many others that. The nickname actually was an artifact from Gabby's upbringing in the Deep South at the turn of the century. Down south, if you see a black boy and want him and don't know his name, you yell, "Hey, Gabby," the catcher said years afterward. He later softened the story as race relations began changing within baseball and America. In Huntsville, he related, he was in the habit of calling everybody he didn't know Gabby. On trains, he addressed all porters as Gabby, and his teammates soon transferred the nickname to Street. The handle unintentionally reflected the catcher's friendly chatter behind the plate, which is how most fans understood it. Gabby became a beloved nickname. Gabby joined veteran catchers Jack Warner and Mike Cahoe on Washington's 1908 roster. Cahoe came to regard the newcomer as the best backstop in the game. "He can't hit much, but he can field and throw," Cahoe said after Gabby's first season with the Senators. "I saw him throw out 9 men at second base in a doubleheader at Cleveland one day, and then they quit trying for an extra sack. He has the pitchers ducking when he snaps to second. I have been in major circles off and on for many years, and his pegging has everything faded I ever saw." The rookie was best remembered, however, not for catching a historic game or for rapping out a vital home run, but for snaring a baseball dropped from the top of the Washington Monument. The stunt on August 21, 1908, settled a $500 bet between 2 members of the local Metropolitan Club. They rolled balls down a chute pointed out the windows near the peak of the 555-foot-tall obelisk. 13 whizzed by before the catcher corralled the 14th. The Washington Star broke the story that evening in a front-page exclusive, calling the catch an unprecedented, though oft-attempted, feat. The Star added the next day, "Very few men have had the nerve even to attempt the task, and those few either didn't come within gunshot of the ball or weren't able to hold it when it struck their hands. But Charlie, who really doesn't look strong enough to catch cold, not only got the ball in his mitt, but held on to it like grim death to an India famine sufferer." The paper rounded up an expert at the U.S. Navy Ordnance Department who calculated the ball had been hurtling earthward at 155 feet per second when Gabby nabbed it. The expert said it was equivalent to catching a 117-pound weight dropped 1 foot. When Street made the wonderful catch, he was in shirt sleeves and wore the glove that he uses in catching championship games, the Washington Herald reported. The Washington Times added, "The most dangerous part of the trick was the possibility of Street's arm being stiffly braced, in which case the jar would have been sufficient to dislocate the member at the shoulder." The ball did not seem to hit the glove any harder than some of those fast ones Walter Johnson serves up, Gabby said. "There was a slight wind at the start, and in the first few trials it made the drop of the ball rather uncertain, and for that reason I could not get to it. When we went around to the north side of the monument, I found it easy, and I succeeded in getting under the ball, which looked about as big as a chestnut, but felt as heavy as a ton of coal." After the catch, he went to the Washington ballpark and caught a good game for Johnson, who 5-hit the Detroit Tigers in a 3-1 victory. Walter Johnson had debuted with Washington as a raw 19-year-old hurler in August 1907. Gabby became his primary catcher after his own arrival in 1908, backed by Cahoe and Warner. Good coaching and managing were fine for a young hurler, the Big Train later wrote, but pitching in a real game with a smart catcher handling your delivery is what brings out the best that is in you. Jack Warner and Gabby Street soon put me wise to most of the tricks of the trade. I followed their instructions and judgment explicitly and so got the best results. Johnson won 14 and lost 14 games in 1908, with Gabby playing in 131 games and Warner in 31. Late in the season, Gabby suffered another in a seemingly endless series of injuries, a foul tip breaking his right little finger. The bones were knocked out of joint and broke through the skin almost entirely around the base of the finger, the Washington Star reported. It was an ugly wound to look at. Gabby pulled the finger back into place, had the trainer encase it in plaster, and assured a writer that the injury was nothing serious. "I have been hurt worse many a time, and I'll be all right in 3 or 4 days," he would repeat similar litanies throughout his career. The catcher had a strong defensive season in 1909, although with a typically low batting average, .211, while Johnson posted a fine earned run average, .222, with 164 strikeouts. But the brilliant feats of Johnson and Street were wasted on a Washington club that lost 110 games while winning but 42 that year, Sporting News recalled long afterward. Johnson followed his 13-25 season in 1909 with a breakout year in 1910, winning 25 games then and again in 1911. Overall, he would amass 414 victories during 21 seasons on his way to enshrinement in the National Baseball Hall of Fame at Cooperstown, New York. In Washington from 1908 through 1911, Sporting News later said, "The battery of Johnson and Street became one of the most famous in the game." Gabby probably was the only catcher ever to urge Johnson to throw harder. Fans once watched the catcher stuff a raw steak into his mitt as added protection against the hurler's fabled fastball. Charlie got fans to thinking that no one but Mr. Street could be on the receiving end of the Johnsonian delivery, Sporting News also recalled. It was good advertising, as a lot of bunk is. The thing went over big, and Johnson and Street became a big drawing card, as Cy Young and Lou Krieger did before them. The potent battery continued until Clark Griffith arrived as Washington's new manager after the 1911 season. He promptly got rid of Gabby and later longtime infielder Norman Kidd Elberfeld as well. Sports pages offered various rationales for the moves. Both stunts were charged by friends of the players as being acts of base ingratitude on the part of the Washington owners. Elberfeld was handicapped by an injury to his hip in 1911, and Street was sick during the winter, recalled a newspaper in Chattanooga, where Kidd ended up in 1913 as a player-manager. Griff was after a winter hard last year and gave the two faithful players no time to come back to condition. Street went to New York in a trade for infielder Jack Knight. President Taft and all the other Washington notables mourned the departure of Washington's favorite player. U.S. Vice President James Sherman wrote to the departing catcher. He expressed the appreciation of Washington fans who have come not only to believe in you as an efficient, reliable, and honest ball player, but as an agreeable gentleman both on and off the ball field. Some sports writers attributed Gabby's departure, however, to the accumulated strain of catching so many of Johnson's powerful shoots, while umpire Billy Evans believed the catcher had used his throwing arm too much for too long. "I have always figured that Charlie Street worked himself out of the big leagues about 5 years ahead of his time. That right arm, once the fear of every base runner, had gone lame. They were running wild. It marked his exit from the big show," the arbiter wrote. The catcher was angry at having to leave Washington and yield his spot behind the plate to Eddie Ainsmith, who had broken in with the Senators in 1910. "I will make them sorry they ever let me go," Gabby vowed. A Pennsylvania newspaper later cracked, "Charlie Street says that getting away from Washington gives him a chance to get a look at a pennant, something of which he has often heard but never seen." The truth was that Gabby wasn't entirely healthy. He later told a sports writer that certain sections of his digestive apparatus were out of order and kept him weak and wobbly all the time. Washington traded him to the New York Highlanders, who would become the Yankees the following year. Gabby played poorly in 1912 and ended the season with the Providence Grays in the Class AA International League. Regaining his health over the winter, he signed to play under Elberfeld with the Chattanooga Lookouts in the Southern Association. Baseball Magazine remembered the catcher later in a poem about ball players who had dropped from the major leagues. Street, the Gabby one. Wherefore and how do names like his drop into the ground? We saw them strut on the dusty stage. They're out of our heads when they're off of the page. The catcher flirted with jumping to the new Federal League in 1914, but stayed in Chattanooga to play under new manager and former New York Giant outfielder Harry Moose McCormick. Gabby signed with Nashville the following year. The Volunteers had a middling season in 1915, but raced away with the pennant in 1916. Gabby received a second nickname in Nashville. After a series of earlier off-season jobs in Alabama and Pennsylvania, he began working during the winters for the New York Central Railroad in the Williamsport suburb of Newberry. The Tennessean supplemented his familiar moniker by calling him the Newberry Switchman. The Vols and their popular backstop opened their 1917 campaign with a 9-2 road win over the Birmingham Barons. But Nashville was hampered by injuries, and the Barons turned the tables the next day during the Vols' home opener at their ballpark, the quirky and aptly named Sulphur Dell. It was Friday, and it was the 13th, Blinky Horn wrote of the 9-1 loss. Nashville soon fell into a tie for last place in the eight-team circuit. The Vols climbed out of the cellar, but were mediocre the rest of the way. On Tuesday, June 5th, the Switchman and his club had a road doubleheader with the Memphis Chicks. This was registration day, when American males between the ages of 21 and 31 had to register for the military draft. The twin affair was arranged at the request of the Chick Mags, in view of the general closing arrangements of all business houses and industrial enterprises in Memphis on registration day, Horn wrote. Monday, as is the case in practically all Dixie towns, always produces rust at the turnstiles. Hence, the Bluff City moguls secured permission of the Vol moguls to stage the two-ply affair. Major and minor league ball clubs playing on the road that day generally ensured that their draft-eligible players registered before leaving home. American men with family obligations or who held essential war jobs could request deferments during registration. Gabby was above draft age and had no obligation, but he had many younger teammates who soon would be in a government lottery to determine who was drafted when. The Volunteers dropped the first game on registration day in front of a crowd of 4,600 fans at Russwood Park. Gabby caught the second game, going 1-for-4 at the plate in a 3-1 Nashville win. The Vols ended the day as they had begun it, in seventh place with the Chicks two spots higher. The Vols' season improved only slightly after that. Gabby hurt a finger for the umpteenth time in late June and missed several days. His club limped along, playing neither badly nor well, as the Southern Association gamely stuck to its schedule. The minor leagues were in rough shape, crushed by wartime travel restrictions, fan bases diminished by enlistments, daytime war work, and other woes. Only 5 of 22 minor circuits completed the 1917 season intact. Ball players in the first call for the Army began receiving draft notices in August, although few were yet ordered to report. The Nashville sports pages printed the names of Vols players and their draft status. Gabby's wasn't among them, since he was nearing his 35th birthday and well beyond draft age. The club returned to Memphis in mid-September for its season-ending series, which the Chicks swept in 3 games. While the locals fought, valiantly defending their fourth-place berth, and the Vols fought just as gamely in an effort to regain the coveted place, which they lost the previous day, the game more resembled a spring practice playing than the finale of a season of work, the Tennessean said. The Vols returned to Nashville, and the players packed to return to their hometowns for the off-season. Gabby chose to drive home to Williamsport, not a quick or easy trip. Gabby Street and first baseman Dick Kaufman, accompanied by their wives, will leave this morning for their homes in Pennsylvania, employing their flivvers on the
sample complete. Ready to continue?